Welcome back to Into the Word, where we are going to resume our story in Genesis chapter 14 at verse number 17, where Abram has just had a great victory over the invading Mesopotamian armies who had plundered the five cities of the plain, including capturing his nephew Lot and taking them all back to Mesopotamia. Now, they only made it as far as the area near Dan in northern Israel before Abram and his friends arrived with their militias, which we've got 318 adult men are part of Abram's household, and he's got three friends who are probably also bringing a similar number of militia members with them. So probably around 1,000 guys. And Abram has them attack the unsuspecting Mesopotamian forces during the night. And of course, that breaks them. And they are routed and they begin to run away toward the north. And Abram and his forces pursue them as far as just north of Damascus and kill a whole bunch of them and collect back all of the stolen material and all the kidnapped people. And then Abram begins heading south along the Jordan Valley back toward Hebron, because that's where he's from. But he stops, and I believe purposefully, at Salem, which is what we call Jerusalem today. It is on the highway. After you leave the Jordan Valley at Jericho area, you go on the highway on the west side of the Dead Sea Valley, you keep following from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, and then eventually you get down to Hebron. So that's the path that he's apparently following. But he stops at Salem, I believe, intentionally. Genesis 14, verse 17, says, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, that's the rest of the Mesopotamian kings, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaawah, that is the king's valley. Now, the king's valley is mentioned elsewhere in Scripture. It's in 2 Samuel 18:18, and it's very clear there that we're talking about the Kidron Valley, which is on the east side of the city of Jerusalem. Now, at this time, Jerusalem was called Salem, and it occupied a little oval hill, not very big, that is south of what we think of as the Temple Mount today. If you go to Jerusalem, and I hope maybe some of you can go with me next May, we go and spend some time at what's referred to as the City of David. The City of David is effectively ancient Salem, the ancient city of Jerusalem in its most basic form. And so that means that the king of Sodom comes up from Sodom, up into Canaan proper, to the city of Jerusalem, to Salem, in order to meet up with the returning captives and possessions that Abraham is bringing back. Now, why? Why are they converging on the city of Jerusalem? My answer is because that is where Melchizedek is. And that is where Abram is coming back to thank God for success in his recent expedition. Because Melchizedek is priest of God Most High. God Most High is one of the ancient names of Creator God in the pages of Scripture. It is a previous name of He Who Is, of Yahweh. So it would appear that Melchizedek is a believer and worshiper of God longer by far than Abram. That Melchizedek is effectively a local priest of God Most High that I think Abram has already met and developed a relationship with. And I cannot prove it by the text, but I do believe there might be some hints of it in the story here. That as Abram was heading north to rescue Lot, I think he may have stopped at Salem and told Melchizedek, priest of God Most High, what happened, and implored for him to pray on his behalf for a good return of his nephew, and that everything would go well in the coming battle. And that once everything happened accordingly, that Abram came back to say thank you to God Most High at Salem. That's my belief. That's my projection as to why Salem was the convergent point for everybody coming back to after this all happened. So verse number 18 of Genesis 14. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine, which when we go to Israel, it's interesting, our guide, the head of the tour company that we use, Omer, when he's taken us down to the very lowest section of the city of David, down by the walls of Jerusalem from this very time period. He says, and this is where Abram had communion with Melchizedek. And I love that. I love that perspective in his head and in my heart, that this was a worship meeting, that Melchizedek met Abram returning from his victory over the invading Mesopotamian forces. And he brought to him bread and wine so that they could fellowship together and with God Most High. Because as it says here, he was priest of God Most High. And then verse 19 says that Melchizedek blessed him. So Melchizedek, think of him like the preacher. He blesses Abram and says this prophetically about him. Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, or creator, if you will, of heaven and earth. This is one of the titles of God. From very ancient times. And, verse 20, blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. So this sounds exactly like some sort of worship gathering, doesn't it? We have a preacher, and we have a worshiper. there is bread and there is wine that marks fellowship between themselves and with God. I am sure that there are sacrifices that are taking place here, and there is a blessing that goes out from God upon the worshipers, and a blessing that goes from the worshipers upon God. So it's a worship service. There's even an offering. It says, and Abram gave him a tenth of everything. This is the very first time that tithing is mentioned in Holy Scripture. And it is done as if it is a normal thing, that when Abram comes back with all of the recaptured property that had been stolen away, that he gave a tithe, at least of the recovered things from Lot, although I think he probably gives it a tithe back from everything, as a thank you to God for a successful and safe recovery of these people that had been stolen away. Verse 21. Now, actually, at this point, you know, I think we need to do some talking about Melchizedek. Melchizedek is mentioned only two other places in Scripture. Hebrews 7 is probably the one you know the best. Hebrews chapter 7 says, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of God Most High, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth part of all the spoils, was first of all, by the translation of his name, king of righteousness, because that is what Melchizedek means, king of righteousness. More than likely, either Melchizedek himself or his father before him founded the city of Jerusalem. That is my guess. Again, we are talking about, right now, this story about Abraham is happening in 2091 BC. And we're pretty sure that Jerusalem has existed since about 2100 BC. So his name means that he is a righteous king, a king of righteousness, and also king of Salem, which is king of peace, because Salam is based off of the root word for peace. It's actually based off of a root word for stability, for foundational strength, and that, of course, is a source of peace. Then it says, and this is the thing that confuses a lot of people, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he remains a priest perpetually. Now, I don't want to go through and teach and preach the whole Hebrews chapter 7 thing here, but this is not saying that Melchizedek is eternal, has no beginning, has no end, and therefore must be God himself. There's a lot of people that try to make Melchizedek into a pre-incarnate representation of Jesus Christ, and that just does not track. If for no other reason, the fact that it says in this very verse, Hebrews 7:3, that he is like the Son of God, which means he is being compared to the Son of God, which means he is definitely not the Son of God. So the point from a Jewish perspective is, you've never heard of Melchizedek in the book of Genesis before this. You find no genealogy about him. You find no birth data about him, no mother-father data about him. You don't see anything about his death and burial later. It's just, boom, here he is, as if he's always been, and then we move on from this story, and it's as if he just keeps on going. So that's the point of the Hebrew writer, is that he is such a nice illustration in this story that you can kind of relate Jesus being exactly like that. He has no beginning, he has no end, he's just there. So that's why then the Hebrew writer goes on and uses the only other passage that mentions Melchizedek character, and that's Psalm 110, which is a coronation psalm. It says this, "He who is says to my Lord," and there is a distinction between those two words, by the way. The first is the divine name. The second is just about superiority. So, "He who is says to my Lord, my master, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool," which this is quoted elsewhere about Jesus being the one that is going to make even death be under his footstool. But anyway, then it goes on talking about this character, and in verse 4 says, "He who is has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." And so the idea of Melchizedek is it is a priesthood that has no beginning and it has no end. That's the Hebrews chapter 7 point. So Melchizedek, in his origin story, in his premier introduction to us in Genesis chapter 14, he is apparently God's preacher at Jerusalem, at Salem. And not only does he lead in a worship service after Abram comes back safely, he receives tithes from Abram from the spoils of that. Tithes which would then be used in keeping the knowledge of God going forth from that very place. Now, I find it intriguing that apparently at some time later, after Melchizedek has passed from the scene, that the Canaanites at Salem, which then becomes Jebus, lose connection with God Most High. It's a sad story that when we have a strong leader that goes by the wayside, either through death or they move on somewhere else, that many of the people in that region, they lose connection. They lose connection with the truth, with God. And so that apparently happens, and it is only when David and the Israelis under David take back control of Jerusalem and make it the new capital city of the kingdom of David, that Jerusalem becomes the center of worship again. But back to our story here in Genesis 14. Let's talk about a non-believer that happens to be there. Verse 21. "The king of Sodom said to Abram, 'Give me the persons, but you go ahead and take the goods for yourself.'" So he basically says, "I'm so glad that you rescued my people." Probably some of his own family members were in this group that had been kidnapped. But he says, "Take the rest as a payment. Take the rest as me saying thank you to you for taking these people on and defeating them." But listen to verse 22. "But Abram said to the king of Sodom, 'I have lifted my hand to he who is God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich.'" So, at some point, either before they went north to capture or recapture all these people, to actually liberate them, Abram had taken an oath, a divine oath, that he was not going to profit personally from the rescue of these people. It could be that he took this oath when he and Melchizedek were worshiping together. That, yes, I'm going to give you a tenth, Melchizedek, of all the stuff that I recovered, but I'm not keeping any of the rest. Because I'm swearing before God, I do not want these non-believers from the valley, the people from the cities of the plain, which we all know are bad people. I don't want them to say that somehow they helped me become stronger and wealthier. So I'm swearing to God, I'm not personally going to profit from this whole rescue. But he does go on in verse 24 and say this, I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten, that is, his soldiers, because they would have eaten out of the supplies, and the share of the men who went with me. So that would be Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. In fact, they're mentioned in the next. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share. So he says, I can't speak on behalf of my friends here. They have a legitimate right, a moral right, to be paid for risking their necks and the necks of their people in this rescue operation. But as for me, I'm not taking anything. You can keep it all. And that, I think, is a very good view into the heart of Abram at this time in his life. He, understand, he has probably not been a believer in the one true God more than a couple of decades. We know that he came into the Promised Land about 2101. And I place this event at 2091. So we're only talking about 10 years. And it seems as if that he had only experienced God's call shortly before he came to Canaan. So for all practical purposes, Abram is a fairly young believer, less than 20 years a believer, I would guess. And so he is a very faithful young believer in trusting God. And I think that helps set the background for the event that happens next. Chapter number 15. After these things, so after the rescue, after all of the adrenaline has drained out of the situation, and Abram is back in his home territory, after these things, the word of He Who Is came to Abram in a vision, and the first thing out of God's mouth is this, fear not, Abram, I am your shield. It is possible, now I'm not going to say this is a definite, but it is possible that after, as I said, the adrenaline drained and Abram began to think about what he just did, he realized he just attacked the combined military forces of five cities in Mesopotamia. He didn't wipe them all out. At least some of them would have gotten away and gone back home. So there is at least the possibility of reprisals from five city-states. And so he may have been a little bit nervous about that. And so I think it would be a very kind thing for God to step in and say, Abram, don't worry about it. I'll take care of you. I'm your shield. You know you won this because of me, right? And I'm not going to let you lose. And then he says this, your reward shall be very great. Now that might be related to the fact he just turned down an awful lot of wealth. Remember, we've already developed this idea that Sodom, Gomorrah, Zeboim, Admah, and Bela, they are filthy, rich city-states. They had tons of stuff, and that's what had been grabbed and taken away. And Abram rescued that and would have had a right to keep a finder's fee out of that, which would have been very big. But he didn't. He turned it down. And so God says here, don't worry about it. Your reward's going to be great, bigger than that. And Abram's answer is something that we will have to develop a little bit more next time, because we're starting to run out of time here, is this. Abram said, "Oh, he who is my God." Now, remember, the divine name does not exist back at this time of Abram. That it is something from Moses' time, and as Moses writes this down, he wants the Israelis, and by extension us, to understand that the same God who is represented by the divine name, He who is the God here. So he puts that name into the mouth of Abram. More than likely, he probably said El Shaddai. El Shaddai is my God, the God of my chest. Abram said, "Oh my God, what will you give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus." So he brings up a problem for the first time here that we have already been aware of from the historical text, and that is that he and Sarai don't have kids. None. We don't know how long they've been married, maybe 20, 30 years. By now, they should have had some children, and one of those children would have been a baby boy that would have been their heir. But they don't have any. And so Abram is bothered by that, and he broaches that subject with God here. And when we come back next time, we will hear God's promise.